poem by Rumi. O seeker, these thoughts have such power over you. From nothing you become sad. From nothing you become happy. You are burning in the flames, but I will not let you out until you are fully baked, fully wise, and fully yourself. The Dharma talk this evening is entitled The Fourth Aggregate. The Fourth Aggregate, Mental Formations. Tonight is the fourth of the series of five talks and 10 classes on the five aggregates. And this particular talk is on the fourth of the five aggregates, mental formations, also known as volitional formations. And the reason that I read the poem I did tonight by Rumi is because really what the study or investigation of these five hindrances allows is how from nothing we become something. What does he say? From nothing you become sad. From nothing you become happy. From nothing. In fact, sometimes we can intimate that nothingness. And we can also see the somethingness that sits very tightly contained upon that nothingness. And it's not good enough to know the differentiation. We have to understand how it is that we compel and propel that differentiation moment after moment. And I don't think there's a better system for studying that, at least I haven't found one, than the Buddhist tradition. And these five aggregates really come to terms with that very self-formation. How does it all come out so that it looks like me? I mean, we add a cup of perception, we throw in a body, a sprinkle of feeling, and a spray of consciousness, and suddenly we're in full bloom. We're in full blossom. And how does that happen? And how does it fool us so regularly, so completely? And so as we study these five aggregates, five groupings, we can get a better sense of how these groupings work in cooperation with one another to make something out of nothing, which is the essence of what the aggregates are about. As I mentioned, mental formations is also known as volitional formations, or in Pali, sankharas. Sans means together, and skaras means make, so they're together makers. Together makers with their help, we come into our embodiment as a sense of self. And karma is very much a part of this particular aggregate. And when we talk about karmic formations or mental formations, the word karma is deliberately used to mean volitionally. These are volitional formations. To emphasize the word karma is to emphasize the word that this is a voluntary act. Now, it may not be conscious, and it certainly isn't for most of us, and what we're trying to do is make it conscious. But we are actively doing this. We are actively creating ourselves from the ingredients of perception and feeling, body. And how we misrepresent that moment after moment, how we misrepresent that process is a very interesting and fascinating study into the mystery of life itself. So we started looking really at the karmic residues when we even talked about the second aggregate called feelings. Now let me back off for just a second and say This is a little more technical. I keep telling you this just to give you some fair warning. It's more like, you know, you're in a high school and you're taking science class now. We have a little touch of literature at some point, and we touch upon other history and other subjects. But this is a little more of the science orientation to Dharma. And my emphasis is to try to make it interesting to you so that you don't get lost along with all these technical phrases, like words karma and that sort of thing, which I rarely use because they seem almost archaic in some ways. But they're very much a part of this whole system of the aggregate. So I throw them in there. And so let's just look at what this word karma means. We can see it in our reactivity. When we look upon something and we have a feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, associated with it, that is an engendered, conditioned feeling that we have had or we have nurtured over time with a particular object. Like if I say chocolate, that may bring up a positive feeling tone in you. It does in me. Or if I bring up another, word like death, for most of us, that doesn't have a very pleasant feeling tone associated. We have learned. Those are learned, conditioned ways to relate to objects. And over time, as we perceive the object, we also perceive within the object the feeling tone associated with it. Like the word mother. If I think, say, tell you the word mother, right? Over time, you have a definite feeling tone and quite likely perception that comes within view when you just say the word mother. Now, also contained within that feeling tone and perception, the perception holds the memory of mother. The feeling tone takes that energetic response of the memory and boosts it forward. And then it holds that feeling tone and sort of propels it with a lot of thinking. So mother isn't just a word to you. It means all the associations of the past and also, my God, she's coming to visit next week. Right? And that's the perpetuation of karma. She isn't here now. The feeling tone acts as a springboard. From the perception, it acts as a springboard, energizing itself, so that the next time you hear mother, you not only hear mother, but you hear she's coming to visit next week. And so it becomes more encased with energy and excitement or not, depending upon what the feeling tone is. So how does this work? So we have at every sense door, take sight, we have sight and the object of sight and sight consciousness. And then between the object of sight and the eye consciousness, there comes mental formations or all of the moods or dispositions that we have in regards to what we're seeing or in regards to the attitude we're carrying for that day. These feeling tones commingle themselves all along the way. We wake up with a particular attitude based upon a particular conditioned response we have to getting up out of bed, to opening our eyes, to being alive. That can be anxiety provoking for some of us. Or it can be self-defeating. And from these simple feeling tones, opening our eyes and seeing ourselves alive again, an attitude forms around them. An attitude and a disposition and assumptions. Now, mental formations include, for the most part, we're going to be talking about thoughts and emotions, but they're also the more subtle meditative states like mindfulness and concentration, tranquility, compassion, equanimity, all of those very subtle states of consciousness that we sometimes have access to in our meditation on retreat or off, are also mental formations. Mental formations really covers a wide variety of different states of mind and being. Now, to the meditator, mental formation is perhaps the most important aggregate. Well, why is that? Because we care about our state of mind. Our state of mind is something that worries us or concerns us. Perhaps more importantly than anything, even bodily health, for instance. And because of that importance that we give to the mental formations that are occurring, it's also one of the easiest routes of entry into mindfulness during the day. What am I feeling? What emotion is going on? What's occurring in me right now? What's going on in me? So it's a step in. It's a road in. It's the way that we can touch and get in touch with ourselves often the most easily. Because when it's not a pleasant feeling tone, we know something's off. We know something's wrong. As our senses become more acute, as we develop a greater sensitivity to those mental formations, mind states, then we are on top of them. When they feel a little bit off, when we're a little fuzzy, when we're a little bit not right there, not really together tonight. And so it's a beautiful entry point. So it's not a small, this is not a small aggregate. This is a major aggregate for those of us who are lay people in the world. And, you know, as these feeling tones mix with perceptions, and as these perceptions mix with mental states and mental formations, and over time we encourage some through our reactivity, through our desires, and as they begin to form their persistence and consistence in our life, that's what we call personality. That's what we call our character. Just the arising of different states of mind through our encouragement or discouragement, because both of those increase the likelihood that they will occur again. Either encouraging something, either wanting it or not. So you can see, for instance, why some of the more discouraging, unpleasant states of mind, for instance, anger, loneliness, depression, etc., can have such a predominance in our consciousness is because we just don't like them there. And we fight inevitably with them when they do arise. And that tension, that unpleasant quality, that tension that we are inviting into the state of mind is the karmic instillment that assures that they will arise to get again in the future. We charge them through the feeling tone and the reaction to the feeling tone of the pleasant or unpleasant quality and from the past associations and the memories. We invite their arising through our aversion. And we will talk about that in the next series with the shadow, because that's primarily how the shadow forms. So we have contact, right, when you notice something. And then there is the feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then the perception of something, which is the memory and recognition of that thing. And then the karmic forces unleashed from there as our thoughts begin to merge in to that pleasant tone, that unpleasant tone, how it's appropriate for it to be here or not appropriate for it to be here. And it gets mixed in with the thoughts which arise from that perception and from those feeling tones and starts proliferating out in terms of an escape route or in terms of encouraging it and running after it. And that proliferation of thought and emotion perpetuates the karma. Perpetuates the karma and the karma karmic formation. So the next time we meet that thing, we meet it not only with the charge of the past, but with the additional aversion that we have just given it through the karmic residue of that immediate reaction as well. We have to understand what we're doing to ourselves. We really have to understand it. It's very sobering when you do. Thoughts, which are karma formations, which is the fourth aggregate, thoughts push the karma forward. The Buddha said this: the thought manifests as the word. The word manifests as the deed. The deed develops into habit. The habit hardens into character. So watch the thought and its ways with care, and let it spring from love, born out of respect for all beings. And we'll get, because the antidote to the energetic reactivity is that let things spring from love, let things spring from affection rather than reaction. And so we'll get to that later in this talk. But already we're beginning to see that with the charged, the kind of charge that many people have, and you can feel the charge in them, you know, when they're, especially in this political culture, as people are arguing, you know, defensively or aggressively and persuasively for one side or the other, you can just feel the invitation that this is going to continue. You can just feel it continue. It's not going to end after the argument ends. You can feel the embeddedment of the very charge and therefore the karmic formation into the future as well. And you get very protective of the reactivity. You get very concerned or immediately aware when that reaction pattern, that passion, turns into reactivity within us. And we're a meditator who is sincere will be on top of that. Because the mental formations really establish our future for us. Why is it that we walk into a situation and react? That just doesn't happen from that situation. It happens from all of the previous cooking that situation had in the oven of our perceptions and volitions and feelings. And as that cooks and thoughts escape, rush out, that reactively rushing out from that feeling tone is what a reactive pattern is. Now, it's interesting because you get a feeling that the feeling of something, for something, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, is not in the thing itself. We went over this pretty extensively a few weeks ago when we were talking about that. The object itself doesn't contain that. The mind contains that when it sees the object. It puts that filter over what it sees, and then it reacts to its internal response. Okay? So too perceptions. What you perceive is really the memory and recognition of the brain. It isn't contained in the object itself. So they're internal responses, not external responses. They are self-defined, not other-defined. This is very important now when we move to mental formations. Because we think the thoughts and emotions that spring forth from those perceptions and from those feelings are other-driven, externally derived. They are not. They are derived internally from the perceptions and from the feelings that have historical reference to that person, place, or thing. So my emotional response to you is not because of you. My thoughts and proliferated thinking about you has nothing to do with you. But you can see how quickly it is that we... That because of the difficulty in relaxing with these feeling tones, basically the pleasant and unpleasant, and the accompanying thoughts which make it not just into a feeling tone, but into a disaster, because that's what thoughts do. It takes the feeling tone and exaggerates it beyond the ability to hold it. Nobody can hold a disaster, but everybody can hold an unpleasant feeling. But the thought makes it into a disaster. It's not just the fact that I split up with, in my relationship or with my partner. It's that I'll never find anybody again and I'll be alone the rest of my life. Nobody can hold that, you see. And so when it turns into a mental formation, a thought, an emotion, then we have to externalize it because it's too disastrous for us to own. However, remember that it is never external. It's never about the other. Never. And so what we have to do is to come back to something that's manageable, bite-sized. Okay, this is unpleasant being separated from him or her. It's unpleasant not being in relationship. It's not forever lonely and desperate. It's just unpleasant. Unpleasant. Don't let the thoughts conjure up in a cauldron some witchcraft. Let it stay just the brew of unpleasantness. I can deal with that. And therefore the reaction is not caused by the unpleasantness, it's caused by the mental formations that arise out of that unpleasantness. The panic. Because the mental formations, the thoughts, recharge the pleasant and unpleasant, making it extremely unpleasant, and the emotions then get embedded within that thought as well. And it's not just, am I making it dramatic enough for you? I missed my calling when I wasn't in theater. But the point is to take responsibility for this. Take responsibility for how we each hold the world. What we see, what we feel about it, what we think about it, and stop pinning the tail of blame upon the donkey of the other. Hold the feeling and you hold the karma. In fact, the karma will continue, but it will be, blanks that it fires. You'll feel the knee-jerk response to react, but it'll be a blank when you just, okay. You just keep bringing it back down to the basics, to the fundamental qualities of pleasant, unpleasant, perception, memory, emotion, and thought. And it'll want to keep reconstituting itself. It'll want to keep constructing a larger picture, a more dramatic picture, because it wants you out of the feeling tone. And it wants the feeling tone out of you. So it'll project the feeling tone onto someone else with its labored thoughts and emotional intensity. And then we will hate the other person for the internal response that we're having. And of course, that's bigotry. Now, attitudes, if you live with a feeling tone and you live with the mental formation that cocoons that feeling tone over time, so that you get up and you just, life has been difficult for you, so then upon opening our eyes in the morning, there's this feeling of difficulty, of just, oh God, life again, this life again. And then thoughts start creating that sort of hazy blur of living. And then an attitude, which is the holding pattern, the assumption that's made from the perception and the feeling, an attitude forms. An attitude forms. And the attitude at its base needs an ongoing assumption. It needs several. One thing it needs is that you're there and I'm here. life is out there and I'm in here. And then once we have that, then we can have the crystallization around that. We can have the wrapping about how terrible life is to me and how awful it is. Once you have assumed the truth of the assumption of the attitude, we will then have the accompanying emotions of that assumption. I cannot accept this. I can't accept this. What we really mean is that we're unwilling to put up with the feeling tone. That's what we really mean. I'm unwilling to accept it. And that statement of assumption reinforces the resistance we have to the feeling. And so then it just keeps, and the karmic residue continues to build. We can see that. And the mental justification that we give with the assumption holds the perception and memory and recognition in place. So one just feeds the other. And the recognition and memory feeds the feeling. The feeling continues to feed the thought. The thought continues to create the karmic residue for the feeling to continue, and around and around and around it goes. This is called samsara. And the Buddha saw that. The Buddha saw that. And he saw that the main point around which everything congregated was the assumption of I, which has its existence based upon one's resistance to the feeling tone. That's where the sense of I thought, the I assumption, has its origin. Because once we resist life, there has to be a resistor to life. And around that resistor of life comes all the explanations of why life can never be what I want it to be. And so to hold ourselves around the assumption of I, me, and mine is like window shopping in order to live. You're looking in at life through a window, through a screen. So it's important, as I often say, that we need to understand what it is that we get out of that sense of assumption of I. But we get a known universe, and I've talked about that many times. We get differentiation in companionship through division. When I'm separate from you, I can get to know you, and we can be friends, and we can hook up to what was originally unity. But we hook up conditionally. We don't hook up unconditionally, or we would lose our sense of boundary. So we want to keep our boundaries and get to know the person partially, not fully, intimately, because then we would lose the boundary. So the point of companionship is to maintain the sense of division, to maintain your sense of division, and to lead separate lives even as we kind of knock together, called friendship. When originally we were like that. And we get distance from silence. That's the other thing we get. Because it requires an enormous amount of inward noise to keep your differentiation going, to keep your reaction pattern from the feeling tone in the perception going. We have to continually chatter to ourselves about how terrible life is, or how we want it to be other than it is. That noise maintains our differentiation. But of course, it also separates us from the stillness that was the original unifying quality to begin with. And we get empowerment and control. Or we get the thought that we are in control. We get the belief that we're in control. Because that's what little entities do who have a lot of feeling tone. They can try to navigate their world so that they get more of this feeling and less of that one, which gives us a sense of empowerment as we go on vacations to nice warm spots when it's cold and wet in Seattle. And we get meaning and purpose from that pursuit. You see how the whole thing just... And there we are. There's everything. There's Wall Street. But what is it? What is it? If you just look, what you begin to see is that there's now, and that the perceptions and the feelings and the mental formations, the thoughts and the emotions, are shadows that we cast upon the now. Shadows. And then the papancha, we papancha out. We put some oil in Puget Sound and covers, blankets the sound. Blankets the sound. My teacher Ajahn Buddhadasa was once asked, how would you describe the world? And he said, lost in thought. Lost in thought. And the shadows are shadows upon the now, are cast just shadows. It's just shadow. We're just shadow boxing, literally. Anger with neighbor is shadow boxing. We create different forms of shadow with the different displays of our mind, and then we chase after them or avoid them. And memory activates that shadow in terms of what it has meant to me in the past, and a whole sense of emotion comes surging in, and thoughts proliferate out about how I need it desperately. And then you have the story of the me playing, casting itself as characters within those shadows. There's a story of a young boy who says to his mother, Mom, if you were in the jungle alone, encircled by 100 hungry tigers, if you were imagining, just imagine this, Mother, that you're in the jungle alone, encircled by 100 hungry tigers, what would you do? And the mother, startled by the question and confused by what she would do, says, well, you know, I just don't know. What would you do? She asked the son. And the son says, well, you know, I would quit imagining. So there we are. How dramatic is your life? How full of heaviness, how much, which is a volitional response to life, your and my internal response, performed, nurtured, and manifested by each one of us. It is us who is doing it to us. We produce the drama and find ourselves established within role and identity in that drama. We create the scenery. We create the division. We create the suffering. Shadow playing. But we refuse to stop imagining. So what can we do? Let's just come back. Let's just come back and look at thought. Because thought has a tremendous influence upon the field of our drama, upon the shadows we cast. And no matter where we are in our practice, we can begin to get a sense of whether thoughts are informed from reality, from what's actually the events as we have described them mentally to ourselves, or whether they're built upon the fabrication of our fears and our emotional responses of what we think they will come from this situation. One can be loosely called sane thinking, just a depiction of what has actually occurred, as best as we can summarize it. Somebody struck my car tonight. It didn't happen, I'm just making this up. Just the fact, just informed from the fact of what's occurred. And then you can feel the emotional response, oh, I don't have much money in the bank, and he doesn't have car insurance, and then it just starts building, and the pressure of life starts building with it. And you can just see that the floodgates burst forth at some point. Emotionally, we become a wreck. Nervous, tense, tight, because our fender was bumped. What's the antidote to that for a meditator is knowing, entering, allowing oneself to enter into that and put an end to that reactivity. Just by feeling, just by acknowledging, just by holding what is arising without allowing it to proliferate into a further dimension of distraught anxiety and tension. Just entering it, just being willing to come in. Because all of this karma volition can only take place when you are not fully conscious of it, when it is covered, obscured with your inattention. So when we enter it with our attention, we enter it with the beginning of a sound resolution of seeing what it is. Because attention, their attention, has the ability to stop the proliferation. My fender, this is just about the fender here. It's not about anything else. I don't have a life-limiting illness here. It's a fender repair. And so we begin to see the two realities, the karmically induced reality, the reality that's induced through the excitation of our thoughts around our feeling tone and our emotional response to that feeling tone. That's the karmically induced reality. And the one that has some orientation to the facts here and now. And to not let the skip occur, the flat stone on the pond, the skipping touches the feeling tone and then skips, touches the feeling tone and skips up into thought, high into thought to come back and touch and skip again. Each time stirring that feeling tone further into its karmic reactivity, propelling ourselves to invite the same reaction more intensely felt the next time similar situation might arise. Insofar only, said the Buddha, Ananda, insofar only, Ananda, can there be born or grow old, can one be born or grow old or die, or pass away or reappear? Insofar only is there any pathway for verbal expression. Insofar only is there any pathway in terminology. Insofar only is there any pathway for designation. Insofar only is there any sphere of knowledge. Only thus can the round be kept going, when there is any designation of the conditions of this existence. See, he said the same thing that I mentioned last week when he said that one will never come to the end of suffering until one knows the end of the world. Because the volitional excitation creates the world in which I have to re-engage. And when we stop here and now, the world with its past and future implode back into the now. The Big Bang recreates itself into the first creative moment. And what karma needs and creates from its need, the avenue through which it runs, is time. Time past, time future. I've got to, I can, I must, I have to, I... And the moment itself in which all these things are arising, conditionally reinforcing one another all along the way, holds none of that. It all falls into nothing, into just the soup of nothingness when we don't move in relationship to here and now. We can't go out and work karmically to undo karma. You can't be reactive to the mental formations because that very reaction to the mental formations is itself inviting more karma. You can't get upset with yourself being upset and expect that to end anything. Do you see that? We have to see that our activity as anything, as an outsider, having some control over our inside is a pure shadow boxing activity that furthers the boxing. Now you're really believing that the shadow is there, creating the assurance that the shadow will even be more personified, stronger and more reactive the next time you meet it. We can't keep doing this. We have to stop. We have to stop. And then it collapses in on itself. How do we stop it? We stop it first through our entering it with awareness. And then asking important questions that forces us to consider the place on which all things arise, which is the stillness itself. Is this true? Stops it. Because nothing of the shadowy world can perpetuate itself when you consider it in the light of whether it's true or not. Is it true? Well, of course it's true. I've got... See, that's not... No. You don't understand. I'm too busy to ask that question. Well, is it true? And then you get a sense of having stepped out, even as the karmic formations continue to manifest in front of your eyes. Even as the embodiment, even as the momentum persists. It's like those cartoon characters. You know, they run so fast that there's a kind of a blur of where they run. And they can cross a ledge where there's no, you know, just by their momentum. That's karma. But you can know you're watching a cartoon. This is ridiculous. And sometimes you'll have a feeling, if you do this and take it seriously, that sometimes you'll be in the middle of an argument and part of you will say, this is absolutely untrue. And you know it. And yet still, you find yourself arguing. And you, there's a kind of a smile, but you can't take yourself out of the argument. That's how strong the volitional forces are. It's okay. That's okay. It's the last roar of a dying lion. Many of us are near the end of our lion's life. Is this true? Because when we ask that question, we're no longer in time. We're no longer buying the picture of having to do it because I've always done it before and here's the same situation and I'll do it again. We don't buy that anymore. We arrest the emotion. We rest the motion and the emotion of the situation by entering it with a question that sees the absurdity of it. So let's just, wherever you feel inclined towards investigating some aspect of this jungle of events that we call I, me, and mine, do so. Because therein you will establish a foothold knowing the untruth of it. And that foothold, if in sincerity you continue to look and to feed on your questioning, will just grow in its stability and platform. So that you'll be able to, even at the, no, I'm just not going there anymore. I can't do this. I'm so inadequate and Even at the word I, it's like, huh? It has no way to gain itself into something you believe anymore. So don't take these talks lightly. And please don't take the homework lightly. Your sincerity is really all that matters to your own salvation, for your own salvation. Thank you. If we could just sit for a minute or two. So if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to entertain them. Yes.
So when you said, I don't want to go there, that feels like often resistance to me. I shouldn't go there.
Okay, so the question has to do with something coming up and you say, I'm not going to go there. Right? And that feels like an aversive response to you. It is. Discriminating wisdom is not aversion. Discriminating wisdom, I can say the same word, I'm not going there, from discriminating wisdom. Because that's wisdom that knows that there's no use in going there. That's not aversion. It's just, I've gone down that alley 20 times, it's blind. It doesn't lead anywhere. And it's just a really willingness, after having investigated it sufficiently, that we just release it. We don't believe it. When you are aversive to something, you believe it to be substantial. And you are resisting the pain that you know you have to go down, that you have to encounter as you go down that particular conceptual path, you see. So you're holding yourself back from it. Discriminating wisdom is the belief, is the understanding that the concept is no longer true. That the truth is not there. Aversion is that the truth is there, I just don't want it anymore, it hurts too bad. Do you see?
It feels like there's a fear of going there.
Yes.
And I should not.
Yes, which is aversion.
But I don't trust that I shouldn't go there because and it does come back. So
right.
Obviously, still in the fear and the should.
Right. So then you have.
It is aversion.
It is aversion. So what you have to do is then fully embody the aversion. So whenever we fully embody anything, we have a sense, we have in essence arrested the karmic residue. I'm just using different words tonight. What does that mean? That means that when you embody something and aren't aversive to it anymore, you're no longer afraid of it. The fear was the residue of the past and what it meant to me. When I can sit with something and see what it really is, despite all the noise and alarm bells going off that say, get out of here, but I'm willing to say, is this true in the face of all those alarm bells? And I can see that from that, my eyes are wide open and no longer obstructed by my fear response. Then I can begin to discern whether this thing actually is benign or malevolent. Not based upon my past, but based upon the present and me not running from it. Then you get a sense, and the next time it arises, of its benevolence. And the benevolence continues to allow you to stop more and more fully until you're not moving at all with it, until you've made that something into a nothing special. Because all things in their essence are nothing. And it's only been our karmic fear and our residue that has made them something. So for us to do nothing with what we think is something is the antidote to the continual perpetuation of this shadow boxing. And it starts with the willingness to examine and investigate. I don't like so much the word letting go, though I use it, because letting go often is really aversion. It's not. I invite investigation. Investigation, you see for yourself that there's nothing to hold on to, and that's letting go. Nothing to believe in, and that's letting go. It's not some willful, contrived, conscious thing you do to something. It's having understood it so thoroughly that it just doesn't move you anymore. Yes. Good. Good for you. Good. Right. 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 So she said that this weekend she had an experience where she was in the middle of an emotional response that usually would have just pulled her right into the wake of its volatility, and she just would have been swept away. But this week, she was able to stop and have time. The time expanded, didn't it? You weren't compelled by it any longer. See, this is the practice working. That's no longer a volitional response. That's awareness now. Awareness is outside of the volitional response, is outside of karma. Awareness can't be touched with karma, by karma. I'm just using these words just to give you a different perspective okay? So you with me? And that's how the practice begins to work. So that should reinforce the value for you of doing more of the same. My God, I can get out of this thing. This doesn't have to compel my life anymore. All my life I've been ruled by my sense of inadequacy or something. And suddenly, you see, none of this has been a lie. All these years we've taught, I've been teaching, you've been coming, we've been hanging out. None of it's been a lie. It's all the absolute truth. Isn't that amazing? It's not like something, I'll take up meditation like I take up skiing. You know, when winter comes, I don't have anything better to do, I'll meditate. It becomes so true for you through experiences like that. My God, the Buddha wasn't just some, flake. It's absolutely the way it is. And you have a moment and you go, and it's so sobering. I mean, that's why, so good. Good. Yes. Yes.
That we do that to create a sense of
boundaries. Yes, yes, yes.
We create a sense of separation.
Yes, 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 yes. We create, yes. A question this has to do with forming our boundaries and then getting into relationships in which the real urge of the heart is to move beyond those boundaries and be intimate. And yet, we continually find reasons not to be intimate, don't we? And to reinforce the boundaries. You see? Isn't that interesting? Because the last thing we really want as a person, as an individual, is to lose the boundaries of self. And so even though our heart finds a relationship to be in, and we give lip service and some workshops towards working in the direction of psychological harmony, still we maintain and find ways to put up barriers so that we'll keep our differentiation even as our heart desperately wants to move beyond it. You can see that. You can see yourself doing that. And what it means at some point when you're involved in a discussion of something and very intimate or very close, and so that there isn't a lot, and you can see what the mind does with that space. Find something to argue about, something to annoy it, some resistance to play upon it. This is not, again, you see, what the mind would love you to do is to get very reactive to that, what you just saw. And then create another shadow to box with. Now this is the shadow that boxes with the shadow that boxes with the shadow. It doesn't care how long the shadows play upon themselves. It just wants another shadow to play with. So what do you do with that? You just observe it. Ultimately, what you do is nothing. Because to do anything is to add volitional reaction, creating a new shadow. So what does awareness do? Awareness sees so that it understands, but it adds nothing to the problem to further the problem. It does nothing. That's why our awareness has to be pristine. It cannot be contaminated with more doing. It has to be just seeing. And that puts an end to the reaction. And from the end of the reaction, the end of fear, the two become one. Yes.
Back to the breath, just dropping them or examining them. I guess I'm a little confused by that.
Well, the meditation instructions, we should all be very... sometimes you need to have a refresher course in the foundation. I mean, really what we're doing now is this is the professional level sports, okay? But my expectation is that you will know the fundamentals, because if you're not going to be able to do anything without knowing the fundamentals. Now, the fundamentals, and it's good for all of us to go back and review again the fundamentals, or we're going to just keep creating karmic residue as we think we're meditating. The fundamentals say, bring your attention as a stabilizing force to your breath, not as a end-all and be-all. Then move out to whatever predominates and investigate that, be it an emotion, another physical sensation, a thought, or whatever might be arising. Hold that with awareness, allowance, observation, relaxation, seeing what it is, and when it dissipates, you can return to the breath or the next thing that's predominant. I have never given the instructions to stay on your breath. We will find a reason to stay on the breath often because it develops into a very pleasant feeling tone. And we don't want to give up the breath. In essence, if that's the reason that we stay on the breath, we are creating karma as we practice. The practice is awareness, relaxation, observation, allowance, investigation, seeing what it is by just exposing our awareness to something. And we have to know the whole range of mind. Because wherever we're ignorant, that's where we're still going to go, creating the unconscious residue of reactivity. So everything has to be known. And if we stay on the breath, how is it that you're going to know everything? So I really want to invite a more sincere understanding of what meditation is. Don't pretend you know it. I would constantly wake up to a deeper understanding of how to meditate for years into my practice. And don't be sold by systems that promise perpetuation of themes of time through staying and maintaining attention on the breath. What does that have to do with anything? Except that it will take you to deeper and deeper, subtler, more pleasant karmic formations. This isn't about that. We have to know what we're doing. We have to understand why we're sitting. We have to understand what meditation is. Primary to coming to this class, please have a thorough sense of how to meditate. And be exploring it all the time, reading about it, going and getting more information. So that we're not just resting our practice on what we have been doing. Okay, so that's it for tonight. Thank you.